You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. How can the most famous woman in a given country skip bail without anyone noticing? This is the question that Thailand is pondering right now. My guests Gaia Lutz, Carlotta Rebello and Tom Edwards will be discussing this and the day's other big stories, including suggestions that Justin Trudeau may have overdone the Mr. Nice Guy bit, suggestions that Emmanuel Macron may have overdone the eyeshadow, and suggestions that young Estonians will vote if they can bring their skateboards. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Gaia Lutz, Carlotta Rebello and Tom Edwards. Welcome all to the show. We will start with Thailand's former Prime Minister, Yingluck Shinawat, who, having been unhorsed, has now decamped, allowing this presenter to get two of his favourite words into one sentence. Those two words, unhorsed and decamped. Ms. Shinawat appears to have skipped town ahead of a verdict on charges she is facing over a rice subsidy scheme that operated while she was in office. The failure of the scheme is estimated to have cost Thailand north of $8 billion. She is looking at 10 years if found guilty. One of her ministers has already gone for 42 years. Tom Edwards, how do you lose a prime minister?
I mean, I think that's a pretty significant question to ask. I suppose that what's interesting about it is it fits with the previous. You know, both Yingluck and her brother Thaksin have a record.
Also of, prime minister at one point.
Indeed. And, you know, he had a record of suddenly not being where he needed to be with the court case pending. And I suppose that those who are happy that there was at least an attempt to bring Yingluck to some sort of justice over this this scandal would say, well, look, this is proof positive that actually, you know, these are people who act with impunity, who consider themselves and behave as if they're beyond the law. And there's a lack of respect for the institutions of and the court structure of the country. I think one thing is for certain, it seems rather unlikely that she'll be back to face this trial or this verdict anytime soon. That would be my guess.
Gaia, it's not a good look if you're an iron-fisted military junta that your most high-profile prisoner kind of just wanders out of the country when a verdict is due to be delivered. But is there possibly an argument, and some sources in Thailand are suggesting this is the case, that balanced against the minor short-term embarrassment, the junta are actually kind of not displeased about the idea that she's left the country and may indeed have sort of left the gate open?
Definitely. I think there are lots of sources implicated that they might have turned a blind eye to her escaping the country, and that you can definitely see why that would be the reason. You know, if she had been arrested, you know, she would be in some senses turned into a victim or martyr. She has a very, very strong support in rural areas, in the poorer regions of Thailand, the famous red shirts. They would definitely have perhaps increased their support, to her if she had been arrested. On the other hand, if she had been acquitted, the opposition wouldn't let that go. She's very, very hated by the middle class, the elites. So it might have been the best outcome in a way for the junta, regardless of the embarrassing sort of primal reaction to it.
Carlotta, I may be strategizing here at a level at which the junta themselves have not, but does this not also kind of work for them on the grounds that if she's out of the country, they can continue usefully to sort of paint her as this plotting menace lurking in the distance who may come back and undo everything, whereas if she was safely in jail, people might start asking, what do we still need a military junta for?
No, of course, and the fact that she's out of the way and not there to, in case they start saying that, to defend herself, works in their favor. And it's hard not to believe these sources that are saying that the military junta had anything to do, that had something to do with her escape. You know, this is, as you mentioned, the most high-profile criminal defendant in the country, monitored by the military around the clock. How is she able to leave? And then the immigration authorities saying there's no trace of her leaving the country. it just doesn't add up. Someone that is so high profile, a case that not only the scandal engulfed most of her term in office, even the few high points of her time in office were completely overshadowed by this scandal. No, she wouldn't be able to just, you know, pass by undetected. People would see who she is. You would recognize her on the street. So there must have been some sort of help.
Brilliantly, no one actually knows where she is. Her whereabouts are a mystery as we go to air. We do know that her brother is in Dubai. Tom, if you were forced to flee the country at short notice, where would you go? I'm always
something I don't know, Andrew.
Intrigued by this idea.
Yeah, I don't know if Dubai would be high on my list. However, if a sort of billionaire sibling was already holed up there, I can see
do you have a billionaire
becomes
sibling?
Eminently more attractive. I guess the point here is that these are people who are not used to staying out of the limelight, and yet they are compelled to find somewhere where they'll be left alone and where they can enjoy, if that's the right word, a low profile. So it's quite a challenge for your sort of, you know, one-time failed, slightly autocratic ruler types. I think it is interesting. If you go back for the junta, and you were talking about this before, Andrew, with what their response would have been, for example, had she been convicted of these charges, or maybe more interestingly, if she'd been acquitted. And that would have been really complicated for them, because obviously you have in the Prime Minister prior to the general now, someone who obviously would maintain that was a coup that needed to happen. Now, if she's cleared of charges, no charges can stick. It makes it more and more difficult to sort of justify that uprising, if you like, and that would be rather hard for the junta to manage. So it is interesting. I wonder whether she'll sort of, rather like Thaksin, just slightly sort of drift out of the picture. Well, I don't know if there's any Premier League football teams that she might be interested in buying in the meantime.
If she was convicted, she would be banned from politics for a minimum of 10 years. So if she can only picture herself as being involved in the party and holding political office, if you're just going to sit around, you might as well do that with your billionaire brother somewhere else, no?
I'm going to ask Carlotta and then Gaia as well. Where would you flee to? I am intrigued by this.
Well, I refuse to give an answer to that. Maybe in March 2019 when Brexit happen, I will let you know my answer. But just a bit too close to home for now for me to even think about it.
And Gaia, you are, of course, from Brazil, a country which historically a lot of people have fled to.
I would go there. I would definitely go
there. Is that acceptable?
Yes, of course, because I have a billionaire brother. I'm joking. I don't have a billionaire brother. But, you know, the country is so engulfed in its own political crisis, I don't think they'd be noticing it any other.
It is interesting, actually. I was going to ask Guy about this, because there are some parallels between this Thai situation in Brazil, in the sense that you have in Brazil former leaders, suggestions of malfeasance, allegations of corruption, and some of the former top dogs, people like Lula, they're almost, you can see, the current political cast of characters finds them more dangerous, more difficult to deal with while they're still knocking around. So I guess that would, again, lend credence to this idea that the current class wouldn't actually be that fussed, but that she's just drifted away.
Definitely. And I find that interesting that she has chosen to flee and not sort of pick this battle. She does have a lot of support. Whilst in Brazil, you know, Lula is really, you know, defying all the court judgments and sort of rallying up more support and playing the sort of martyr and victim of harassment and accusations. Whilst I think Yingluck, maybe because she knows of her guilt, maybe because she doesn't have the energy to fight this battle, maybe because the junta is much stronger than the police in Brazil, but she's chosen not to fight that battle. And I wonder how politics would have turned out if perhaps Dilma had fled after impeachment. Or Lula.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Canada, where Justin Trudeau is learning that there are two sides to being perceived as decent and generous when it comes to welcoming refugees and migrants. On the upside, you are perceived as decent and generous. On the downside, eventually enough refugees and migrants will turn up that the patience of your people begins to ebb. Trudeau appears to have reached this point of the trajectory as more and more people arrive on foot from the United States, which is, of course, presently run by someone for whom appearing decent and generous is not a priority. Carlotta, was this backlash against Trudeau, and it's not, I mean, people are not yet, you know, protesting in the streets and setting fire to things outside his house, but there is a certain amount of grumbling about these people arriving from the United States in particular. Was it inevitable? Could this have been managed better?
No, it couldn't. This is just a a tiny portion to what Europe experienced at the height of the refugee crisis. True. From the Med. So, and we saw the backlash that happened there. And it, of course, the numbers were completely different. But it's inevitable when you're talking about people entering your country, the old argument of, oh, you need to take care of your own people before you take care of others, ignoring every other sense of moral dignity and respect towards other human beings. But, you know, so far this year has been 11,000 people that have allegedly crossed to Canada by foot from the United States. Now, that's a huge number, because you're just talking about the people crossing by foot. You're not talking about the other ones that come in through the other programs to arrive to Canada and to get settled. They Trudeau's government has been forced to turn Montreal's Olympic Stadium into a welcome center. And there's plans for another city, in Ontario, to have another one. So it just makes you question... When you ask if it could have been managed better, I really don't think anyone has the perfect model of how to manage such an awful situation.
Gaia, there has been some complaint that Trudeau encouraged this influx, and it is 85. The people coming across on foot from the United States are mostly 85% Haitians, who are apparently fearing closure of the humanitarian program under which they're permitted to stay in the United States. But in January, when Trump was doing his, or attempting to get his Muslim ban to happen, Trudeau tweeted, "To those fleeing persecution, terror and war, Canadians will welcome you regardless of your faith. Diversity is our strength. Hashtag welcome to Canada." Some people have suggested that this was a somewhat reckless impression of open borders.
I think just bringing back something that Carlotta said previously, I think the backlash was inevitable, but perhaps not because of the problem sort of we face, but because I think people are very uncomfortable when politicians say something and then sort of have to walk back on their words. And I think the problem with Trudeau here is that he did get elected on a platform that was very sort of open and welcoming.
It was a bit "I'd like to teach the world to sing."
Exactly. And then it turns out you see the reality and the... I think if politicians, you know, from the start, as horrible as it may be, set very conservative agenda to immigration, people perhaps are less infuriated when they hold up their word. But I think definitely he might have caused a bit of a wrong impression. I don't think to his own fault in a way, you know, when your neighboring country is saying, you know, things that they'll ban Muslims coming from to the country. I think it's important to say, you know, to not be grouped in the North American sort of region and show that you're a different country and show the contrast between your nation and the United States. And I think in doing that, he sort of put himself between a rock and a hard place.
Well, his most recent outburst, Tom, outburst statement, was he said, "You will not be at an advantage if you choose to enter Canada irregularly. You must follow the rules, and there are many." Is this something he should have made clearer earlier?
I think he should have done, but all he's fallen victim to is it's the same dynamic that we have with politicians in this country who are campaigning to leave the European Union. It's all well and good adopting a position on something as a point of principle or as a counterpoint to another voice that you find particularly distasteful. In this case, as Guy said, I think most people said more power to Trudeau when he came out and said, yeah, Trump does not speak for North Americans. There's a warm welcome awaiting in Canada. It's just that tweet, or however he broadcast that sentiment, would have been less compelling if he'd said, brackets, of course, just check the small print, you do need to still tick the boxes and, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's. This is the nature of government. You would have thought Trudeau, with his background, would be more aware of this than others. You know, he comes from this political dynasty. You can't just do politics by sound bites. Trudeau's the friendly, acceptable face of trying to do that, as opposed to Trump, who does it by self-serving and, frankly, completely distasteful soundbites. But there's a degree of similarity, which is that it's trying to sell easy messages to people. I actually think that populations are smart enough and sanguine enough to accept that with whatever opportunities there are come certain responsibilities. I think it would have been fine if he'd said, there's a warm welcome for everybody, but you need to check the right boxes. I don't think people would have criticised him for that.
But I like that he also, this week when he was speaking to the press on this issue, that he made a case for differentiating between asylum seekers and economic migrants, saying, you know, it's about being vulnerable, being exposed to death or torture or being stateless, not for economic reasons. And that obviously they have to, you know, process the reasons why you're claiming asylum. And I think... obviously, when he first tweeted that you just mentioned, Andrew, if you're fleeing a war zone, you're not going to check the regulations. You just want to get the hell out of there.
But I think what people are taking issue with now is that these people are fleeing Minnesota.
Yeah, but when they're fleeing the U.S., they're fleeing the U.S. for two reasons. The end to that program that gives asylum to the Haitians, that we're talking about 85% there, and also the rhetoric coming from Donald Trump's administration, you know, what used to be a safe haven is not anymore. You don't feel safe in what should be, you know, the West, the modern society. And in particular, what makes this case from the US to Canada so complicated as well is the Safe Third Country Agreement, which is the pact that the US and Canada have signed, I think, 2004, which means that migrants have to register for asylum in the first country they arrive. So even if they flee to Canada, Canada has to send them back to the US because that's between the two nations, the one that they arrived first. And these temporary tent cities and welcome centers and completely non-human places for people to live are also part of this process of sending people back, and that cannot be easy as well.
Tom, why is it that all discussion, there's an easy answer to that question. I'll ask the same question differently. Is there a way that discussion about immigration can be conducted in such a tone that it doesn't go from zero to absolute screaming fits on both sides in nothing flat?
Regrettably, Andrew, I fear the answer is no. And you see, the general standard of debate around this issue is so disappointing. And it remains. It's the flashpoint. When we talk about Brexit, this free movement.
That was a referendum on immigration.
It's pure and simple. And that's a depressing reality. But I suppose in some strange sense, it's reassuring that we see the same dynamics around the world. I mean, I'd slightly take issue with Carter on that point about economic migrants. I mean, the point about people seeking better lives is they're seeking. Maybe it's better opportunity. Maybe it's a more supportive environment for them to do work for which they're qualified that they can't do elsewhere. It's only people trying to better themselves. And we know in this country that all migrants contribute positively to the economy, for example. So I've always found
you
that
are outnumbered 3-1 at this table.
Yeah, I was going to say, my point is not saying that economic migrants are a bad thing. I'm one of them. So
yeah, and I just think, but that's what we need to try and remind people on. But as you say, you're shouted down every time, and I just can't understand the invective and how rapidly the argument descends. I think it's again back to this idea that the politicians, certainly in this country, probably in the States as well, just they're not up to it. They could be maintaining the standard of discourse if they were capable of it.
And you always end up having the old argument of the good migrant versus the bad one based on whether it's skills or nationality, where they come from, in all these countries where these debates come up. And as you said, it's up to the people leading each of these nations to change the way we talk about an issue that affects so many that, in all honesty, you'll never know if you'll ever be in that situation. So you should be careful with the words you say.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Carlotta Ribello, Gaia Lutz and Tom Edwards. Coming up next, confirmation that French President Emmanuel Macron has created at least one new well-paying job, that of his makeup artist.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Carlotta Ribello, Gaia Lutz and Tom Edwards. Now, France's president, Emmanuel Macron, has consistently given the impression of being a man rarely displeased with the view in his shaving mirror. The news that, in his first 6 months in the Elysee Palace, he has managed to rack up a €26,000 makeup bill, therefore comes as something of a shock, especially when one considers how rarely he has appeared in public entirely covered in gold leaf. I'm approaching this from the point of view that suggests that not only is 26,000 euros slightly too much for a grown man to have spent on makeup in 6 months, I think it's about 26,000 euros more than a grown man should spend on makeup in his entire life. Carlotta, am I missing something here? How is this actually possible?
I definitely haven't spent 26,000 euros on makeup in my entire life. I mean, when you think about politicians and people that do a lot of public speaking and television debates and all of that, it is expected for them to wear some sort of makeup, especially.
Really?
Yeah, especially.
Would anyone notice if he didn't?
Yeah, you would actually on television, especially. But when it comes to, you know, male makeup for television, it's very much, you know, just make sure you're not shining, and that's it. The fact that you've spent 26,000 in just 3 months, I really want to, for someone to just, you know, look at the amount of public speaking in the last 3 months, see if we can trace down exactly how much each of them costs, makeup wise.
The money, in fairness, is the total of two invoices from a makeup artist who travelled with him, prepped him for press conferences, especially, and, you know, really, best of luck to the makeup artist. It's nice to see a self-employed person land a good gig. But this is it's absurd, isn't it?
I love this line from the Elysee Palace that says, we called in a contractor as a matter of urgency, trying to figure out what's a makeup urgency.
He had a pimple, presumably.
The first thing that struck me in this news was that it perhaps was a very bad investment, because I'm pretty sure with 26,000, you can get a pretty good facelift and then just not have to do it for the rest of your life and not spend it every 3 months. But yeah, the amount is really shocking. And I also did some very rudimentary maths, and I just divided that since he was in power. And that comes out at almost 300 euros a day. And that's pretty shocking. I mean, I do my makeup every day free of cost. I mean, I charge much less for Hollande if I was doing his makeup.
But it's not just Macron. And I don't know how common this is in the governments of Europe. But François Hollande, his predecessor, spent 120,000 euros a year on makeup and nearly that much again on a hairdresser.
Well, I always remember Hollande's hairdresser was on 10,000 euros a month.
To do what?
For the presidential.
You tell us you cut your hair every play. 2 weeks or something.
but seriously,
if we're looking seriously here, the problem is...
I'd have been François Hollande's hairdresser for half that amount, and I don't think anyone would have... What do you have to do?
I don't know. You probably might not get the gig. I don't know. He might look at your hair and then...
Well, you make a reasonable point.
But do you remember the hairdresser for David Cameron got an MBE for services to hairdressing because he moved the partition from the left to right or right to left?
The symbolism.
He charged 90 just for cut and dry.
There's a comparison here, I think, with what we're talking about a little bit about someone like Trudeau and the luster coming off these remarks because of political reality. What really strikes me about this isn't so much that he spent the money on makeup. We saw Hollande spent more on hairdressing. It's more that there's less of a sensitivity about it, given what a hot political potato. Personal spending, expense accounts, employing staff, and that kind of thing is that was an absolute, you know, marquee issue during the campaign. You had people like Marine Le Pen using it as a stick to beat everybody with, particularly Macron. And you would think he would be mindful of this idea that he's a polished showman, you know, a bit of a Johnny come lately, not a real heartland politician, but too polished. I would have thought he'd say, guys, look, definitely can't be spending tens of thousands of euros.
I'll get my hair cut at the place on the corner for 20 euros a go.
And when I'm appearing on TV, we know that the TV, they have their makeup. He doesn't need it. I think it's a worrying sign about his value set, particularly in the early days. And, you know, there has been some unflattering stuff about Macron, that he's slightly self-regarding. I think you said not displeased with what he sees in the shaving mirror. It doesn't help. And I'm just amazed, given the scrutiny on all politician spending in France, that he's not been a lot more politically savvy.
It does seem that's the thing that's weird, isn't it, Guy? That no one seems to have thought to wonder how would this look in the newspapers.
Definitely, and you know, especially given that, you know, just a month ago or so, he wanted to give Brigitte official first lady status. So I mean, he's not completely blinded, but he's been shown to be a bit blinded to these things that we would have thought, you know, someone would have said, well, that might not play out so well in the future. But maybe, you know, looking at other, you know, how much Hollande has spent or Sarkozy has spent, perhaps he was, you know, saying, you know, I'm spending less than Hollande, and perhaps, you know, that's normal in France.
But it doesn't fill you with confidence
in terms of
the way he's appraising these big challenges. You know, he needs to restructure the entire economy. I hope his maths gets a bit better.
Well, let us look finally at Estonia, which is the latest in a bewilderingly long list of countries to flirt with the folly of reducing the minimum voting age. While anybody with any understanding of democracy's crisis understands that the argument should be in the opposite direction, 47 seems like a sensible age to raise the franchise to, Estonia hopes to lure 16 and 17-year-olds to imminent local elections with such attractions as skate parks and similar enticements. Carlotta, are we excited by the participation of the kind of people who only show up because there's a skate park?
I think that's not exactly the point here, Andrew. Well, I don't think they will just show up.
It is exactly the point. If they would show up without a skate park, you don't need to build a skate park.
Well, they would show up without the skate park, but they're not allowed to vote just now for the first time. So that's why they didn't show up before. I think this is once again, politicians and grown-ups not knowing how to deal with the under-18s, or in this case, the 16, 17-year-olds that are voting for the first time and assuming that a skate park will do it. Well, what if you don't like to go to a skate park? What if your priorities are actually your 2 years from going to university and you want to know how to pay for your tuition? I think it's once again the case of throwing the word millennial at them and thinking the same argument.
I'm not sure 16-year-olds now are millennials, are they? I think they're post-millennials. What comes after millennial? Nobody answer that question. I don't care. Tom, why do we want people even younger voting?
Well, to me, lowering the voting age is sort of the opposite of Spinal Tap amp that goes up to 11. What we need to do is make sure that everyone who's eligible to vote now votes. I know in certain countries around the
Australia,
globe.
Australia, for example.
Present company included. It's mandatory to vote. This is a much better way to ensure that everyone takes part and delivers on their democratic responsibility. We should compel people to the ballot box. Frankly, there may be an argument to lower voting ages to 16. I'm unconvinced. I think 18 is decent enough as anything else. But everyone from 18 plus should be compelled to vote. I wonder whether you were sort of alluding to the Brexit vote with your age cutoff at the upper end, as tempting as that might be. Make it mandatory, and I think you'd immediately see better functioning democracies.
Gaia, the thing that worries me somewhat seriously about the idea of lowering the voting age is I can remember being 16, and I can therefore remember that there is no end of idiotic nonsense I would cheerfully have voted for at that age. How big a problem is that?
Oh, to be honest, I think I made better choices at 16 than I do now, which is not a good thing.
Are we still talking about politics?
No, but I mean, I don't think, I have to take point with you, Tom. Brazil also has mandatory vote. I'm not sure that is the way for more inclusiveness. I mean, a lot of people do show up to the ballot box, but they vote blank, or their votes are bought by political parties. So I'm not entirely sure that would be the way forward. I think lowering the voting age can be a way to engage the youth, not necessarily the best way, but I do think they could have, just going back to your questions, given better incentives. I mean, you know, you could offer, you know, free, public transport for a couple of months or
Sounds
something.
Sounds suspiciously like buying votes again.
Well, skate parks are practically the same.
Well, you read that Adam Smith Institute report on the Millennial Manifesto, how the Tories can take votes from Jeremy Corbyn, the youth vote. And one of the most ridiculous one was what they call the Ibiza tax. That is, under 30s should stop paying air passenger duty because that will allow them to travel to visit family and friends.
This is great. This is encouraging people under 30 to leave. That's a brilliant idea.
But to come back, return ticket. But I loved how also in that, like how to get the youth vote was legalizing recreational drugs, including cocaine, cutting the national insurance, for under 25s, 50% discount on council tax, and a graduate tax to replace student loans. Some make sense, some are just insane.
Well, that's one of the things I would have voted at 16 would have been the decriminalization of drugs. And I think I'd still vote for that today in Brazil, at least.
Well, on that constructive note.
And around the world.
world. Let's do it.
On that constructive note, that is the end of today's show. Carlotta Ribello, Tom Edwards and Guy Lutz, thank you for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Bill Luty, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Isabel Rosen, Audrey Fyodorenko, and I can't see who the studio manager is because Guy is sitting at the end of the table. More music next. 1900, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. No, it doesn't. It returns on Monday. Who wrote these goodbyes down? Bill Luty, producer, I'm looking at you. It returns on Monday at 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. I just read out anything that's written down in front of me. Thanks for listening.